This is the Get Still Carry Podcast, Season 9, Episode 28. And welcome to the Concealed Carry Podcast, part of the ConcealedCarry.com network, brought to you by HK. Today is Wednesday, March 13th, as of the recording of this episode, and I am your host, Riley Bowman, and also co-host, producer, Brian Doc McLaughlin.
Thanks for having me on.
Of course. I'm glad to have you on. He was under the weather there for like a week or so.
I was pretty sick.
Yeah, yeah. Had a couple guys actually in the shop here actually down for a couple days here and there. So really glad to have Brian back because we actually planned this episode a week or two ago now actually, and it didn't happen because he got sick. So anyway, really glad to have you back, man. Today we're actually doing our second installment of what we're calling our Uncensored Beginner's Guide to Training. This second installment we're calling Create Your Dojo. We're going to talk about dry fire practice, particularly how to do it, how to go about it, how to set up your home or your office space or your garage or whatever, and also tools and resources that you can use to make it more effective and to help you. So that's the focus of today's episode. I'm excited to dive into it with you.
It's going to be good stuff. I think beginner things, I'm always looking to enhance the fundamentals and to relearn all that that small stuff. I feel like that's where you get a majority of your progress is if you understand those fundamentals really well. And if you can do that at home and practice that on your own time and for cheap, that's even better.
Yeah, I agree. Awesome. But first, today's episode is sponsored or brought to you by dryfireproshop.com. It is your one-stop shop for all things dry fire product and resource related. Hope that you'll consider checking out dryfireproshop.com and giving them your support, which supports directly this podcast. So thank you for your support of our sponsors. And also Guardian Nation. GuardianNation.com, of course, is the link, the website. Guardian Nation, many of you should be familiar with already. If you're not, that is our membership program that folks join and on a monthly or quarterly or annual basis and get a ton of amazing benefits, including all kinds of free training in the Guardian University members area. Also discounts on products, including memberships like CCW Safe and other things.
Dry fire products.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You'll get 10% off everything sold at concealedcarry.com just by being a member of Guardian Nation. So there's many reasons to join today. So consider signing up at guardiannation.com. Again, thank you to our sponsors and thank you to your support of our sponsors. That's partly what's enabled us to continue doing this podcast after 8 years.
Yeah, it's been a while, huh?
Yep. Can you imagine when we hit a decade?
Coming up. The podcast is doing great.
I don't know, man.
Seems to be like, enjoying it.
10 years just seems so long
to
do, to do a thing. So let's go ahead and get into today's episode. First of all, creating your dojo. Okay, we'll tackle this a couple different ways. Let's talk about setting up that dojo. Let's talk about training at home. That's a good place to start. It's, I think, really important that we set ourselves up for success in the space that we're going to be conducting our dry practice. So what are your first thoughts on creating your dojo?
Well, I think coming from the beginner perspective, what are your thoughts on why they should do this? You know, what are the pros and cons of doing dry fire practice as opposed to going to the range and doing live fire? Do you have some thoughts on that?
Of course I do. So first of all of the high-level shooters, performers, and this is true on the competition side as well as on the defensive or tactical side, but those that have a high degree of skill usually have such because they've done a fair bit of dry practice. So like that right off the bat should be a clue to all the rest of us that if you want to get proficient with, particularly tools of defense, that they are technical physical, tactile tools that require skill development. And the way skill development is going to happen is by good repetitions and a lot of repetitions. And while you certainly can learn in live fire to get, to learn pretty much all the things and get really good, it's not always the most effective way of doing that, especially from a cost standpoint, right? Mm-hmm. And so dry practice, or dry fire as it's more commonly known, is it's basically no cost or low cost, relatively speaking, compared to, range fees or a range membership. Of course, you may have a lot of that anyway, but it's certainly cheaper than live fire just in terms of ammunition cost and expenditure, right? Because every time we pull the trigger in live fire, there's a cost associated with it. Every time. There's no getting around that. Unless maybe you get your ammo given, your ammo's given, I guess there's still a cost. I'm thinking of those that like maybe work for the government, for an agency or something, and they get, a fair bit of ammo allotment. But in the end, we all still pay for that. But anyway.
All right. Well, let me play the devil's advocate here.
Sure.
Riley, I'm pretty rich, man. It doesn't bother me to go to the range that often. I'm not too worried about that. Why would I want to dry fire?
So I do think that there are some things that actually make a lot of sense training in dry practice as opposed to in live fire, because so part of skill development is not only doing a lot of repetitions of a thing so that you learn, all the nuances and the steps and everything associated with that skill. I mean, like, let's just focus on, say, like the draw, for instance, right? So to complete a draw, particularly if I'm doing it from concealment, like, I'd be carrying here today, right? What do I got to do? I got to clear a cover garment out of the way. I got to get my hand on the gun. I've got to have good access to the gun to do that. I've got to get a good purchase on the gun, get it out of the holster, right? Marry up two hands on that gun, proper grip, extend to the target, and fire a shot, right? Okay, so could I do that in live fire? Yes. However, part of skill development is what's known, chunking is one of the concepts that's often discussed, which means like you want to take like individual components of a thing or of a skill, and you want to work on those individual components, and then eventually you chunk those together, and that makes the whole thing, right? And so by that, I mean like one of the steps of drawing your gun is getting the cover garment removed out of the way so I have access to the gun. Another step is just getting that initial contact point on the pistol and doing that consistently, right? Mm-hmm. So here's where I'm going with that, Brian. Where I think a lot of people fail that overemphasize learning or doing skill development in live fire. Not that that's a bad thing. However, it's easy when it enters into the equation that at the end of a thing, you're going to have a bang, right? It's really easy to get hyper-focused on that because, there's a bit of a dopamine hit, right? Like a bit of a reward of, I got to go bang. And right, and so it actually can take your focus away from those individual components of that skill that you really want to isolate. And that's what we're talking about here. This is a principle that Matt Little, my friend, is really acquainted with and has talked about actually on the podcast. I can't quote to you exactly what episode number that was, but if you go back in history and find, I think Matt's actually been on twice, but I think the most recent time he was on, we talked about skill development, and we talked about isolation drills, experimentation drills, which is one thing, but isolation drills, which is what I'm talking about right now, where we isolate very specific parts of a skill so that we can get max skill development from that isolation. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then, yes, there's a place for combination drills, okay, where we put more things together to test if the thing we learned in isolation still holds up. Okay. But so my point is that there's a time and place where you want to just isolate. For instance, part of my drill or part of my draw skill development has entirely been focused around just doing this one act. It's actually two actions there taking place, meaning garment clearing and getting gun or hand on gun. And then just making sure that happens correctly, and then reset and then do it again. And then reset and do it again and over and over and over. You can see every time, like I I don't miss getting this hand on that in the exact position it needs to be for consistency every time, because I've done that isolated skill over and over and over and over and over again. So again, sometimes we go to live fire, we're so focused on the bang, bang, bang aspect of that, that it's easy to overlook that there's smaller chunks of isolated skills that really make sense to just work in dry practice, even if I have all the money in the world or all the ammo budget that, you know, that I can manage.
So what I hear you saying is that, one, it's easy for you to focus on the mechanics of what you're doing and sure, each step-by-step that you're doing. And then, two, you're able to put all that together in a way that helps you to focus on the overall process without the end goal being the bang, which tends to distract your training, at least to a degree.
Exactly.
So then you use the dry fire practice to get better at all of these things, including the presentation. And then when you're at the range, you get to put all those things together and then add accuracy. Is that?
Yeah. I mean, that's certainly one approach. But yes, you are on the right track as far as, and that's how I approach my personal training, is there's a lot of things that I isolate and drill and drill and drill and drill and dry practice, because I can focus on those things, like hyper-focus on them and get those component skills very, very well dialed in. And of course, we want to take it to the range and put it to the test and see how it holds up.
Well, that last component of the training is the accuracy component.
Yeah.
And that's where you pick that up on the range, right? So you get to put it all together and see how well you do. And I really like what you were talking about how you would just do your, get your combat grip on your gun and then go back to reset. I think something that really helped me when I was starting to learn all these things was breaking everything down into a step-by-step basis.
Exactly.
Step one, clear cover garment. Step two, get a good combat purchase on your pistol. And then you work through each step all the way to presentation until you actually press that trigger, practice your trigger control, your sight alignment, your grip, and all that, and make sure that you still all have that. And then you can put it back away and do it all over again from one step.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Spot on, dude. So let's continue on the, and by the way, thanks to everybody that's tuning in live and watching. I really appreciate it. Mark, it's good to see you and have you commenting. Guys, of course, you know, you're always able to catch the podcast live when we record them on YouTube, on Facebook as well, on the Concealed Carry Facebook page and the concealedcarry.com YouTube channel. Feel free to share, please. And, you know, we always appreciate that. And of course, if you're not catching us live and you're just listening on your favorite podcast app, I mean, we always appreciate you as well. We may not get the live, you know, interaction with those of you that catch the replay, if you will, but certainly you can always contact us at our podcast hotline email, podcast@concealedcarry.com.
I'd love it if you guys dropped a comment down below, said something about how often you dry fire practice and how long you've been dry fire practicing. I think that would be very interesting to know.
Yep. Or if you're not doing dry fire regularly, why not? Let us know. Not that we're here to judge or anything, but we definitely want to help
you. I'm judging. You better be dry fire practicing.
But we want to help you all get better. That's why we're here. That's why we're having this conversation. I mean, after all, this is the uncensored beginner's guide to training. Let's continue talking about setting up your dojo. So let me just kind of explain. Let me explain two sort of, I guess, procedures that I, you know, follow, Brian. Both in that, I actually do quite a bit of dry practice here in the concealedcarry.com headquarters. In fact, right just off to the side here is where I filmed a lot of the shooter ready challenge videos that we used to do. You know, we quit those just a few months ago. By the way, I'm going to mention those again and tell you where you can still access and watch the whole archive of all those shooter ready challenge video series. But sometimes I'll actually make use of the warehouse, especially, you know, after hours, there's, you know, nobody here and I kind of have free reign of the place and, you know, I got a little bit more space. And so I'll set up and do a little bit of dry practice also in the warehouse space. But I've done a ton right here in this room, just to the side where we record the podcast. But also we'll talk about home, and let me start by talking about home. So, you know, one of the big things with dry practice is, it's not uncommon for there to be mistakes that are made. One story that comes to mind is it's actually a Facebook post I saw in a group a couple years ago. And the gentleman posted about having just shot his fridge. He put a bullet through his fridge. Okay. So he was doing dry fire and unfortunately was not safe enough, was not aware enough, was not following the proper procedures or protocols. And so he obviously thought he had an unloaded gun, but yeah, and fortunately, nobody was hurt or injured. And that is incredibly fortunate because there are instances where that is not the case, where people do get hurt seriously or killed from unsafe gun handling and dry fire practices in the home. But he put a bullet right through his fridge. And so we don't want to see that, right? So a couple of things we want to make sure we hit on here today. So first of all, I think it's good. Now, I already mentioned that I sometimes do dry practice here. I sometimes do it in the warehouse, but I also sometimes do it at home, right? I think it's good to, whenever you do it, to have, if where possible, to do it in a consistent space, to where the space is kind of the same. You know, like you sort of have this dedicated area of your home or your office or wherever it might be, that's where you do the dry fire things, okay? And the reason for that is because then you can introduce a series of protocols, if you will, safety protocols, meaning that, for instance, like here's one suggestion, and it is a suggestion. I definitely think this is a good thing for you to do. We've talked about this before. I remember Jacob and I talked about this once upon a time as well, talking about how one step or one approach is to, so you create essentially your dry fire dojo. So let's just say this space here in this room is our dry fire dojo. And right over there is a door and the threshold of the door. And I am not going to allow live ammo to cross the threshold of that door to come in here when I'm doing dry fire, right? So what could I do? I could actually walk over to our safe in the shop, use that as it's a pretty legit safe. Use it, you know, I could keep my gun inside the opening of the safe there, unload my gun, do whatever I got to do there. Put the ammo away and then, or even lock it away. Also a good idea. Lock away my loaded mag or any live ammo that came out of the gun, lock that stuff away. And then I cross the threshold into basically a sterilized space where no live ammo comes into this space as we're going to do dry practice. So that's my approach at home. And I'm fortunate, like many Americans are, but not everybody is, in that I have a basement in my home. It's truly below grade and it's, you know, all 360 degrees. At some point, I'm going to encounter a concrete wall. I actually don't have any bedrooms that anyone resides in. We have a guest room in one part of the basement, but down there's not generally people. There's just there's a big room and there's a couple of rooms actually. One of them is my office, my home office. So, but that whole space can be sterilized and go down there and not have any live ammo within reach or handy, or it's all locked away. And then I can conduct safe dry practice, right? And so that's a part of this creating the dojo, is to create the space and set it up in a manner where you do the dry fire things in the dojo, in whatever space that is, whether it's a room, whether it's a garage. Now, I did mention that I, you know, talk about doing some dry practice here, also in the warehouse portion of the headquarters here, but follow the same procedure. If that's the dry fire dojo today, then okay, no live ammo over there, right? In the space where I'm handling guns and doing the dry fire things, okay? So we want to still follow all the same basic rules of firearm safety, right? So, you know, making sure that we know the condition of our firearm, making sure that it's unloaded when we need it unloaded, double checking that or triple checking that where we need to, making sure, you know, or being mindful of where the muzzle is pointing, what we're doing that way, you know, and where possible, it's ideal, obviously, to have a true backstop of some kind. The nice thing in the building that we're in, it's not necessarily true of like some of the side units that, you know, we have some neighbors to the sides here. But a lot of the exterior walls are solid, like CMU block or stone. Like the front is some kind of concrete stone facade. And so, you know, that's nice because, you know, I can actually use some of these walls for like true backstops, which is good. So where possible, it's good to think that through and create your dry fire dojo built around that. And I already kind of mentioned in the basement, as long as I've ensured there's no one else down there with me, then I got basically, you know, pointing the gun up is a problem. But as long as I'm keeping the gun horizontally or down, I can go any direction I want to because I've got safe backstops everywhere.
Yeah. This is an important concept, guys. I mean, if you're new to shooting and you're new to dry fire practice, making sure that you have a sterile training environment is very important. It's easy to get complacent, especially if you're walking in there and say you have a mag loaded up with dummy ammo and you're sitting there training and you're not paying attention. You accidentally pick up a mag with live ammo in it and you pop it in there. That's a pretty common thing that can happen. Happens all the time. I know I went to Front Sight. That's the one in Nevada.
Yeah.
I went to Front Sight with my
now
dad.
Now defunct. It's actually been taken over by a company called Prairie Fire.
Yeah. Yep. Well, when I went there a couple years ago, one of the things that they said when I was checking into the hotel down there was like they said there was going to be an extra fee for replacement of mirrors if you shot a mirror. Mm-hmm. Because it was pretty common for the students to show up there to take a class at Front Sight and then go back to their hotel room and practice what they learned on the range that day and not pay attention and actually put a bullet through the mirror because they're watching themselves be super cool, you know, in the mirror. And so they wind up putting one right through the wall in the mirror. So
not cool. No. Speaking of which, since I do a little bit of traveling, and sometimes that travel is because of big like USPSA matches, like national championships or something I'm traveling for, or maybe it's a class I'm going to teach. But especially like major matches, because I'm going there to compete and I want to do the best I can, it's not uncommon I'll do dry fire, you know, the night before the match starts, or
which is totally fine if you got the right protocols.
Right. And so you might be in a hotel that's, you know, multi-storied. You've got, you know, units above you, units below you, folks to either side, basically completely surrounding you. I've certainly been in those situations, and it's a little bit unnerving to me when I see some of my friends sometimes post dry fire videos of them in a hotel room. And like I know they're safe. I know they're responsible people. But I'll tell you, one of the things that I do when I'm on the road, especially, and I do it at home too, and I do it here in the office. I actually do it quite a bit here. In fact, all the guns that we have on site for like holster manufacturing purposes for test fitting and all that, everything is barrel blocked, and I use a barrel block at home. And that's just, I mean, it gives you an extra layer of reassurance, of security, of, you know, you can put that barrel block in and know, and very obviously seen, it should protrude a little bit, at least from the end of the barrel. You should be able to check the chamber and see that bright orange in the case of 9mm. They are color-coded if you're not aware. So like 380, I think, is blue. And by the way, the colors are all, like there's blue and there's green and there's yellow and there's orange. They're all intended to be pretty brightly colored, even when they're not like the common 9mm bright, you know, kind of hunter orange color that is the most common one, because that's the 9mm version. But anyway, use a barrel block, put the barrel block in, and then you can kind of do sort of whatever. I mean, you still want to be safe. You still want to follow all the same protocols as best as you can. But a barrel block does make the gun essentially inert and will not allow ammo to get fed into the chamber. I like to also use the mag block that ships with every barrel block. Actually ships with three. So you can stick those in your magazines and you can check and confirm that the magazines, if you're doing like, you know, reload practice and stuff like that, because you can check and make sure that there's no live rounds in the mags, and you can essentially certify that by inserting a mag block now into the magazine. So now it's like, okay, I look at my magazine, I see an orange mag block, and I check my chamber and I can see I've got the barrel block installed, and then I pretty much will do whatever I feel I need to do for that dry fire practice session. And I generally try to keep things oriented towards, like in a hotel type situation where I've got units every which direction, I still try to do most of my work facing the exterior wall, 'cause I still feel like that's the direction of least consequence. Yeah, having a barrel block, that's really, you know, we're talking about setting up the dojo and talking about protocols. That's one of my protocols now. And I don't think I have it with me here today, but I often have a barrel block in my back pocket because I dry fire pretty much every day. And so several months ago, I finally was like, I should just have a barrel block with me all the time.
It's part of your EDC now.
You know? Yeah. I mean, because it's not uncommon it would not surprise me one bit. I'm not saying that I'm going to today. I have actually a lot on my plate today, but it's not uncommon that, you know, middle of the afternoon, I'm sitting here in the shop and it's like, let's take a quick breather, you know, need to step away from things, whatever. Unload the gun, throw a barrel block in it and do some quick dry practice for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, I do that all the time. And I know that some people will talk about, and this is a good suggestion, by the way, some people will talk about having dedicated dry fire or guns dedicated for dry fire, because they can basically keep it always unloaded and always barrel blocked or something like that. And that certainly is a great way to go, because I'm not doing anything to compromise my actual carry gun when you do that. But not everybody's able to do that. Not everybody's able to have a copy of their EDC gun that they reserve for dry fire practice. And so, you know what? Follow all the safety rules. Have a barrel block handy. Stick it in. Do your dry fire. When you're done, pull the barrel block out. You know, if you got to, if it's your EDC and you got to load it back up, load it back up. Do the thing. Not a big deal. But be safe about it. Follow the safety rules. Create some protocols that allows you to create your dry fire space, your dojo, so that you know that, hey, in this space, I am doing dry fire things. Okay. And then, and this is the other key thing, when you're done, and this I think is where some mistakes have happened with some folks, is they get done, you know, like you just got done practicing draw, present, press trigger, or whatever it is, right? That's the most simplistic dry fire thing that a lot of people do, but there's certainly way more that you want to be doing in dry fire than just simply drawing and pressing the trigger one time each time. But when you're done, you got to basically say, okay, I am now done dry firing. I am, like, when we're done and my gun's loaded back up and it's going in the holster, I'm done. There's no more draws. Okay. There's no more repetitions.
Mm-hmm. Why not?
And it helps to leave the actual space where you're doing the dry fire and be like, no more of that. Okay. Why not? Well, so the why is because it's very easy to go, you know what? I'll just do one more rep. And it could also be that you got interrupted by something. Maybe a phone call came in, you stepped away for a minute. Those are also huge, huge potential opportunities for failure in this sort of thing. And you just don't, you know, like, for whatever reason in the moment, you forget where you're at, what you've been doing, what the condition of your gun is. And it's like, I'll do one more rep. Draw. Bang! Instead of getting a click. It's happened. It's happened. And so we got to be intentional about, here's the space, here's the dojo. I'm stepping into that space. I'm doing the dry fire. When I'm done, I'm out and I am not touching the gun anymore because chances are it's loaded back up. Does that make sense?
Yep. That makes sense.
So that's probably some good protocols to follow. There's some things I've learned from experience. Been fortunate that I haven't made any mistakes, you know, like what some of the things that we talked about, because I've been diligent in following those protocols. Okay. Use your brain, use some common sense, follow the rules and come up with protocols that also work for you in your specific circumstance, because we're talking generalities here. We're talking about best practices, but what I do might not necessarily be exactly what you do, because my situation may be a little bit different than your situation.
And what kind of targets do you think they ought to be using?
Well, I think you can use a lot of different targets. I like a lot of the scaled targets. Okay. And by that, I mean, mostly because usually we're working in relatively confined space, right? So I like practicing as close to 1-to-1 as I can, in that on an outdoor range, you know, I might be working at 5 yards, 7 yards, 10 yards, 15 yards, whatever the distance may be. Well, I only have a couple of rooms in my home that are actually 5 yards across, or maybe slightly more.
I see what you're saying. So right? Scaled, you mean they get progressively smaller or larger,
right,
to represent how far away they might be.
Right. So a common thing is actually a lot of dry fire targets are 1/3 scale. Mm. And actually we have some on the wall over here.
Yeah.
And you can go to, so this is actually, you bring up a good point. One of the resources, and by the way, there's a ton of resources listed in the description, in the show notes of today's episode. One of those links that's in the description or in the resources is concealedcarry.com/print targets. OK, Okay. We have a whole repository of free targets that you, that anybody can just print off and use for live fire and dry fire. And certainly some of them on there are more intended for live fire versus dry fire, but they can honestly be used both ways. I've seen a few people send me photos of them using one of our 1/3 scale USPSA targets, live fire at the range, and that's fine. But really what the 1/3 scale targets are usually intended for is doing dry fire inside like your living room or your basement or in this office room here, where, you know, from there to there is like, I don't know, 15 feet maybe. And I can use a 1/3 scale target. And the beautiful thing about a 1/3 scale is so often at the live fire range, we talk in terms of yards, 5 yards, 7 yards, 10 yards. I mean, sometimes people say feet or sometimes they say meters,
right?
But it's very common, especially in pistol training, to talk in terms of yards. Well, how many feet are in a yard?
Three,
right? So if you're using a 1/3 scale target, guess what? However many feet away you are from that 1/3 scale target is the, it's the visual equivalent. It's the relative size, the same way as if you were looking at that same target in full scale at whatever that number is in feet, but in yards. Mm. So if I wanted to practice the equivalent of dry fire practice on a 7-yard target inside this room, okay, on my scaled down target, that 1/3 scale means if I put that target at 7 feet, visually, it's the same difference as if I was on a live range with a full scale target at 7 yards.
That makes sense.
Okay. Yeah.
That's a cool resource.
Yeah. And that's actually a thing that people sometimes get confused about, but it's really not that complicated. If you only work with 1/3 scale targets, the math is super simple. So I do that all the time where it's like, I'm working on this drill thing and I want to do it at 10 yards. And so I'll set up my 1/3 scale target at 10 feet. Easy. I also have some targets that I'll use that are like 1/6 scale or 1/4 scale. Those you kind of need to run, crunch some numbers or whatever. Or sometimes I'll throw up things and not necessarily care what actual, or representational distance they're at. It's just I'll put it up kind of whatever distance I feel like I need to be working on. But 1/3 scale works great. And so many of the targets on that resource I just listed, concealedcarry.com/print targets, are 1/3 scale USPSA, IPSC and IDPA targets, which I think are pretty good to use. Not that you have to use those, but they are humanoid in shape. They're pretty representational, I think, of the type of target areas that we want to be training for. Arguably, those hit zones could be smaller and tighter. But there's also some other targets on that free targets page that you can use a variety of different ways. Including making things more challenging or more difficult for you if that's your jam, which is never a bad thing. I think anytime we should be making our training challenging, right? Because if it's not challenging, we're not going to grow.
And it's not going to be fun. There's like a sweet spot. It needs to be just challenging enough to push you, but not so challenging that it overwhelms you.
Yeah. Hey, good comment here from Scott on Facebook. He says, good tips. Also, don't dry fire when you're tired. I would say, yeah, similar to not handling firearms when you're under the influence of drugs or alcohol, including prescription ones, but also when you're tired. Like, be super careful about handling firearms because you're much more apt to make poor decisions and to make mistakes when you're not 100% mentally, right? And so that's a really great, I'm glad you commented that, Scott. I really appreciate that. And I'm really glad to see your name pop up and know that you're tuning in today. So the dojo, you asked about targets. There's a whole bunch of really great ones you can use for free right off our website. You can use whatever. I'll sometimes, and this is a simple thing. If I'm traveling and I'm not able to really like take a whole bunch with me, I'll just take like a small little, stack of, sticky notes,
Post-it notes. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of times just using the Post-it note itself is good enough for me, for my purposes. But you can also draw on them too, which is, that has benefits, as well. So I can kind of make whatever you know, and granted, they're only what, 3 by 3 inches or whatever. Yeah. But, you know, when you're in, say, like a hotel room or something, like chances are I'm not standing much more than 5 or 7 feet away from them anyway. So I can also draw some scaled down targets and to make things a little bit more challenging if I need to. So just be creative and look for, you know, ways to use things.
And how long do you think that they should try to be dry firing?
Oh, sure. So I'm a big believer that honestly, if you can do anything you can do consistently for like 10 minutes a day is going to make huge progress for you.
Okay. So you're not talking about like getting in there and they're slaving away for 2-3 hours.
Oh, no. Right. Certainly not even 2-3 hours. I would say like a long dry fire session, certainly a long one would be like an hour. And I've done hour long dry fire sessions for sure. Those are a grind. Half an hour still is a pretty good session, but most people don't have that kind of time. Mm-hmm. Most people don't even need that per se. Like when I've really pushed with the serious long, you know, dry fire sessions was, I was really trying to prepare for something very specific, a big match, for instance, right? And I had a specific, you know, maybe a certain thing from a previous match that was bothering me that, you know, I needed to get worked out of my system, like struggling with reloads or something, you know, and it's like, okay, let's work on that. And I'll just grind and grind and grind and grind, you know, trying to get whatever that shortcoming was, you know, sort of figured out. I think though, honestly, if you just take, and sometimes it probably doesn't even take 10 minutes. If you're really focused and really dedicated and really intentional at what you do, you can probably do 5 minutes a day of drive practice. If you do that consistently, you're going to see, return on investment from that for sure. 10 minutes, I think, is honestly, I think 10 minutes is probably the sweet spot for a lot of people. Not so short that you're, I think, selling yourself short. Like you can do some good work in 10 minutes, but it's not so long that it's difficult to do. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. And just about anybody should be able to fit 10 minutes somewhere into their day if they care enough about it. Right. You know?
Yeah.
It's like, what are some other things you're doing where you're giving up 10 minutes from your day? You know, that could, you know, be just, hey, stop watching so much TV, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you're learning a good skill. You're using your body. You are doing something, you know, productive. I think that's an excellent way to kind of round out the end of your night, you know, kind of chill out a little bit before you start going to sleep and that kind of thing. So what would be an example, do you think, of a 10 minute training schedule for somebody who's probably doing, what kind of drills might they do at, you know, like what would that look like?
By the way, this is feeling like an interview.
Yeah, well,
I think it's awesome. It's great. Like Brian's asking all these great questions. So let me give you an example of like a simple 10-minute session for me. So what that looks like a lot of times, and I'm going to try to keep this simple. So because honestly, and relatable, I think, to where a lot of folks are at. One of the big things I see consistently from shooters is they could use more proficiency in drawing their gun. Okay. A lot of times it's just inconsistencies that they're not quite gripping the gun the same way every time they go to grab and draw from a holster. Some of it is working through some just slower parts of their draw, like where there's hesitation for whatever reason, where there's like little pauses, where there's inefficiencies, things like that. Draw, I think, is really important. And I think it's one of the easiest things to work on in dry practice. It's not the only thing you should be working on, but let me just use this as an example, a simple 10-minute session. I will typically, and I do like working with a shot timer, by the way.
I was going to ask that, what you use for that.
Not that you have to, but I do think a shot timer is a beneficial tool in dry practice. So I would take a shot timer, and wherever you are at, like you should have kind of an idea of about where your skill level is at. Mm-hmm. So if in live fire, you are pretty consistent at being able to draw and put a single round on a target at 7 yards in say 2 seconds, then it's 2 seconds. Okay. For me, it's right around a second. Okay, especially for concealment, which is pretty smoking fast, all right? That's not where most people are at, but it's something I've practiced a lot. And that's why it's like I can do a second draw pretty consistently. So what I would do is for probably about the first minute of that 10 minutes, I would take my shot timer and I'd set a par time on it. So, and with a random delay start, so that when I hit the button, I get myself in whatever position, hands, you know, below wrist below belt, or hands up in a fencing position, or whatever, you know, it could be that I'm holding something, you know, holding an object, and I'm going to practice dropping that and then drawing. Whatever it is, I get in position. When I hit the shot timer button, I want a random delay start. When that goes off, it's going to go beep, and then it's going to go beep, right? That's going to be the second beep, which is going to be the par time beep. So if my baseline of what I can kind of consistently do in live fire is like a second, then I'm going to start actually at about 1.2. Okay, so like 20% slower than what kind of where my baseline performance number is. Okay, and that's essentially my warm up. So it's no different than, you know, like the other day I did a 4 mile run up Green Mountain, and yeah, I'm not a big runner.
4 miles, is
but I did not run 4 miles. I spent about the first 3/4 of a mile walking. Mm-hmm. Warming myself up, you know, before I got into any running. So, and that's advisable. Like before you go do any kind of physical activity, like you should warm up, you should, you know, maybe do some walking, you know, you want to stretch, you know, do those kinds of things. So for me, the warm up and dry fire is kind of the same thing. It's so I put my par time where, when I start it at about, you know, about 20% slower than what my baseline is. And I'm not trying to do anything crazy, but it's just, okay, do the reps, do them perfectly, right? And at a 20% slower pace, super easy to do, okay? And that's just warm up. And I might only do, say, 10 reps at that pace. And then what I'll do is I'll start stepping that down. So then I'll go down to 1.1 seconds, 10 reps. Then I'll go down to 1 second. That's my baseline. 10 reps, sometimes maybe 20, kind of depends on the time I have. At this point, you're probably about 3 minutes into your dry fire session. Okay.
So you're starting off slow. You're working your pistol draw first. You're starting off slow, and then you're slowly ratcheting up the speed.
Correct.
To your fastest time. So you're not just starting off trying to go as fast as possible right out the
gate. Now, 1 second's not my fastest, but that's sort of my baseline. And so I should be able to do that pretty consistently already. So that's why it kind of depends on how I feel. So a lot of times it might just be like 10 reps at my baseline, and I'll be like, yeah, I'm feeling pretty good. Let's go to the next level kind of thing. If there's days where I'm a little bit off, I might do a few more reps at my baseline. So that's a little bit by feel. So then I'm going to set the part time to 0.9 seconds. Now you're starting to feel a little bit of pressure, right? Because that I can in dry fire, I can get 0.9 pretty good still, but starting to feel a little bit of pressure. And at 0.9, I might do 10 reps, but I might do 20 reps, just depending on, again, on how I feel. If I'm really nailing 0.9 that day, like I'm really just dialed in, okay, cool. I'll do 10 reps. Now let's push it further. So now the par time goes down to 0.8. Okay. And so, all right, we're down at 0.8. Now I have to actually be really like on point to hit a 0.8 from concealment, especially. And so I'll do that. I'm probably doing like 20 reps. Okay. And then if I want to keep pushing it, I'll go 0.7. And I do. I often do this. And I'll try to get, and it's really important when you're doing this, especially for draws or anything that's part-time based, you are essentially your own judge. And you have to be honest with yourself. It's really easy to be like, here, and then start to hear the beep of the par time and be like, oh yeah, I got that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got it. No, like you should be actually conservative in your judgment of, did I actually beat that par time or not?
You're only cheating yourself.
Yeah, exactly. So be honest with yourself and just be really hyper aware of everything that's going on, both with what you're doing, because that's important. That's part of the learning process. And also, you know, where am I at? If I'm using a part-time shot timer in this manner, like I'm describing to you, like it doesn't do me any good if I'm not being honest with myself. And so basically the idea is then to just step your way down until you kind of hit a point where, like for me, I like to get to where I fail about 60, 70% of the time. at whatever that par time is. Okay. And because that tells me, okay, now we're kind of hitting some limits, right? Mm-hmm. But that's where the growth honestly starts to happen. If you're still doing good reps, quality reps, if you're doing it intentionally, when you get to a place where it's really pushing you, that's where the growth happens. Okay. And a lot of people do the same thing over and over and over again and never really push themselves and realize that in dry practice, that is the time to push yourself. And that's actually another point. I meant to mention this earlier when you asked about, well, if I have an unlimited ammo budget, like why should I dry practice? Well, another reason is in dry practice, especially when I'm following proper safety protocols, especially when I'm doing like a barrel block or something in my gun, there is virtually zero downside as long as, again, I'm doing it intentionally and I'm paying attention to what I'm doing, there is very little downside in me pushing the envelope of my performance, mm-hmm. of speed, especially. Stuff that I would do in dry fire that is safe to do dry fire because it's dry fire, there are things that I wouldn't necessarily do in live fire, or at least wouldn't push myself that much,
right?
Because there's a risk there. Because if I push too far, too hard, too fast, and I foul something up, and next thing I know, I've got a bullet hole in my leg, or I've got a dropped gun, you know, which is never good, you know. So there are things that we can practice in dry fire that, because of the safer nature of that, right? Because of the environment we've created, the protocols we're following, there's things we can practice in dry fire that we wouldn't necessarily want to practice in live fire due to increased risk.
Yeah. I love what you also said about doing everything perfectly. I know something that I would do when I was first starting my dry fire journey was I would go too fast because I want to be fast, right? If I'm going to train, I better be fast. That's not how it works. And then two, I would notice that I would flub my draw, but then I would just work through it anyway.
Sure.
And something I would do instead is that every time that I would mess up like my initial grip, I'd stop myself, reset, shake it out, clear my head a little bit, and then try to do each one slower and perfectly so that each step is exactly right, nice and slow. And then, like you said, start speeding that up, mm-hmm. you know, putting all the steps together and then do it a little faster and then a little faster and then a little faster. And then once you start maintaining that for a degree of time, pretty quick, like you're going to get a lot faster.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned that too, because that's exactly kind of, so what I've described so far would take me 5, 6, 6.5 minutes of my 10-minute allotment. So what would I then spend the remainder of the time doing if I was, again, this, just keep in mind that in this context that I'm discussing, this is purely just working on draw mechanics in dry fire. There are other sessions, and it's not a bad idea, by the way, to have like Monday's my draw day. Tuesday, I'm working on, you know, reloads. Wednesday, I'm working on transitions or whatever, you know, and you could spend 10 minutes a day just on those things, right? And then kind of rotate back through some of those sort of focused skills that you're working on, rather than doing like a session where you work on all these different things in one session, which is also viable. I'm just saying there's different approaches here where you can have different days that you focus on different things, kind of like, you know, hitting the gym where you got, you know, leg day and you got, you know, arms day, you know, you're doing however you break that up, upper body, lower body, core, or, you know, whatever. So I'm glad you mentioned that, because the next thing, if I've got like 3 to 4 minutes left, Brian, then I'm going to particularly look at when I was pushing myself and I started experiencing failures, then I'd want to identify what were those failures, right? So if it was a grip purchase problem at the holster, meaning that when I start trying to push for that 0.7 and I'm not quite getting the grip properly, consistently every time, like there's just something there that's not quite right. Okay. Well, then what am I going to do for a minute or two?
You're going to focus on that.
Right? I'm going to just focus on that. And that's where I'm going to get into the micro drill of just doing this and then resetting, not even pulling the gun out of the holster, right? Just boom. Okay. Reset. Boom. And it's good to just pause and actually kind of evaluate, be like, is my thumb where it should be? Is this finger where it should be? Is this finger and these other fingers, you know, and just thinking about and evaluating, did you hit that grip the way you need to so that it's consistent every time. So then you're going to micro drill the failure points, and that's where I'd spend the rest of my time. And then when I get towards the end, so let's say I'm at 9 minutes, I got 1 minute left. The final thing I'll do is I will put it, whatever I was working on, all together one more time. And essentially at or maybe just slightly beyond my baseline performance time, I'll spend that last minute just work it, just doing that. So I get good, clean, successful reps. I want to leave that dry fire session on a positive note of success. Okay. We put in the work, we identified some things, we worked on some things, and now put it back together before I wrap it up for the day. So I don't walk away frustrated, like, oh, I'm having such a hard time sticking this reload. Okay. Micro drill out the thing if you're just not quite getting it angled right or whatever, you micro drill that thing out. And then that last minute or so of your dry practice session, just go back to what you know at the baseline speed or time that you can do consistently. And then do that for a minute or so you get some nice, good, clean reps that you can walk away from and be like, awesome. Because right. If I had to use my gun 15 minutes from now when I step outside my door, like that's the last thing I want to remember is I know how to do this. I know what to do. I know that I can be successful. And you've got the confidence to deliver that performance.
Right. You're also being introspective about your training. You're being very self-aware of what it is that you're doing. You're being very methodical about how you approach it. I mean, you have no choice but to grow if you're going to do something like that. I think it's essential because you're also going to be practicing each one of these skills. You have to turn your weaknesses into your strengths. I mean, it's pretty normal for human beings to, avoid those things that we're not good at. But once you start to kind of look at what your training is and how you're doing it, start to figure out where your hangups are, start to pound those away, and pretty quick you're come out on top.
Yep. Awesome. We spent quite a bit of time talking about that. I think it's all good and relevant and important. But let's shift gears a little bit here. Let's talk about some of the products that, we've already talked about Barrel Block quite a bit because one, it is very useful. It's very safe. It's very simple. It's also very affordable. It's actually one of the more affordable dry fire oriented products. What are maybe some of the other products that you have experience with?
My next favorite choice would be the dummy ammo. Mm-hmm. I love that because you get to work reloads, malfunction drills, all that kind of stuff. So I love the dummy ammo for all of that kind of thing. I like running through and having a couple in my magazine and then going through and working my rack and the slide and that kind of thing, and then also getting the trigger press. Yep. So I think that's my next choice for the next most valuable dry fire training.
Awesome. Yeah. Yeah. Dummy rounds are great. By the way, we sell the Ready Up Gear, which is our brand, Ready Up Gear Dummy Rounds. We actually went through it took almost 2 years, redesign process on the dummy rounds, made them better, more awesome. And they are frankly still a heck of a value because they're one of the best price options that you can find out there for dummy ammo. Check out Ready Up Gear. There is a link in the show notes for the dummy rounds, but on readyupgear.com, you'll find them. Also on Dry Fire Pro Shop, one of the episode sponsors today, dryfireproshop.com. I should mention that I think pretty much everything that we talk about in today's episode, as far as products are concerned, you'll find those products on their individual respective websites, but you'll find them also at dryfireproshop.com. That's why that website exists, is to kind of be that one-stop shop for all those things. So you'll find the Ready Up Gear dummy rounds on dryfireproshop.com. Let me give you – well, so I do want to – before I mention some other products, I'm going to piggyback off of something you said. And I do want to make it clear, by the way, that other than I think a barrel block is really good and important to have because especially if you do a lot of dry fire, I mean, I think – having a barrel block is a no-brainer. Simple, low cost, have it, use it, put it in the chamber, in the barrel of your gun, and it's just a good idea from a safety perspective. But do you need to have products for dry fire? I would say no, because I mean, really what you'd need is, basically your gun and a holster and a barrel block, wink, wink. But you could do a lot. And in fact, that's what most of my dry fire practice just involves that. My holster, my belt, my gun, and a barrel block. And you can get a lot of good work done in dry practice with that. However, I do see a place for a lot of the products. And I've used everything we're going to talk about today, I've used. And so I think that they have a place, and I think that we should use them when appropriate and with a specific purpose in mind, right? So I'll give you a couple of examples, like the CERT pistols. CERT pistols is great.
I love CERT, yeah.
Yeah. Great product, been around now for over a decade. Mike Hughes and Britt and their whole team over there, fantastic people.
If you guys don't know what this is, these are the, they look like an M&P or a Glock, and they are red, and they fire a little laser out of the front. So we sell those on the website as well. But those are awesome because they have all the same controls, except the slide doesn't rack. Mm-hmm. But all the other same controls and triggers, so you can work on your trigger control and your all of your different mechanics.
Yeah. And CERT stands for Shot Indicating Resetting Trigger. That's where the name came from, meaning that shot indicating, meaning there's a laser that's projected from it when it's, quote-unquote, fired. And resetting trigger, meaning that you don't have to now rack the slide every time between shots, because the little laser cartridges, which by the way, we sell, it's called the Laser Dot Trainer. It's also one of the recommended or resource products that you'll find a link for in the show notes today. With those types of products, unless your gun is a double action gun, you would put the product in the chamber, the laser, cartridge, if you will. And every time you press the trigger, you're going to have to rack that slide to then be able to press the trigger again and fire that laser off, right? Mm-hmm. Again, unless it's a double action gun, which certainly there are some of those. But in today's world, more and more guns are striker fired, so you're racking the slide between reps, right? So anyway, just know that that's one of the huge benefits of a CERT is you can work through a bunch of things and do repeated shots really quickly, because you don't have to work the slide in between, right?
So, and you could use your holster and your style of gun, kind of.
If you run a Glock, you want the model 110, which is their Glock version. If you shoot a P320, you want the model 20. If you shoot a MMP, what is that? It's like the 118. I don't remember all the model numbers, but they have an M&P style one, right? So yeah, 100%. So they're not going to have CERT pistols that are perfect analogs for every gun out there, but you can usually find something at least is somewhat close to what you typically use or carry or shoot. If your typical gun, they don't make one for, but it has more of like a rounded grip profile, then you could probably want to look at either the 320 or the M&P styled CERT pistol.
Yeah.
If it's got more of a square grip profile, you want to probably look at the Glock one. And, you can look at some of those features and kind of make the best decision that gets you somewhat close to what you typically train with. Cool Fire Trainer. This one's actually really exciting.
Can I ask your opinion on these CERTs? So one of the things I like about the CERTs is I kind of treat it like a little bit like a toy. Mm-hmm. And I'll sit on my couch, and I'll be watching a movie and I'll just be working reloads, or work on my presentation, and that kind of thing. Do you feel like that would be a bad training scar to be working that like that? Because I really enjoy it because it kind of helps me just do repetitions and practice like my presentation and picking up my sights and that kind of stuff. But I'm also not doing it in a very methodical or very, purposeful way.
Well, I would say this, that one of the nice things about the CERT pistol is that it, and I don't necessarily like to refer to, such things as toys, but due to the nature of the product, it is something that is certainly safe to do that sort of thing with. And so I'll, let you make that decision as to whether, that's good, for you or not. I do think that what you're doing is probably not necessarily bad per se, but I do think that you would get greater benefit if what you're doing is more focused and deliberate.
So don't make that my only dry fire practice. Have some methodical, actual set aside time for my dry fire practice. But if I did that in addition, it wouldn't be that big a deal, you think?
And of course, as we've already mentioned, in all things, be safe.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Good question. Cool Fire Trainer. This was a product I was really excited about when I first came across one a number of years ago, because what it does allows you to use your actual gun and you replace the barrel with their barrel, which their barrel is actually a small compressed air tank which you then charge with a CO2 tank, like a paintball gun tank or a SodaStream tank, you know, CO2 tanks that are under high pressure, and they got special adapters, and you install the CoolFire barrel into your gun. You install their recoil spring into your gun. You put your gun back together, and now you got the CoolFire installed. And typically the end of the barrel of the CoolFire product is the charging valve, meaning that's where the gas goes in, the air. And so then, you know, I've got like over there, you can't see it, I know, on, you know, you guys, but on the video feed here, but I've got a SodaStream CO2 tank with an adapter on it that mates up with the CoolFire product, and you just press it onto the valve and it charges the barrel with gas, and then your gun functions pretty much just like your gun, right? You press the trigger, the striker or the hammer falls. It actually pushes in on a small little valve, which is where the primer of the round would typically be. But in this case, it's a small valve on that CoolFire barrel that allows it to shoot some gas back at you. It then actually has a rod, if you will, that protrudes from the CoolFire itself and actually initiates cycling of the slide. That's how it works.
Yeah.
Super genius, super smart. And they have them for more and more models of guns all the time now. Like compared to what they used to have, you know, 5 years ago, they have not everything, but chances are you'll find a CoolFire trainer for your gun, as long as you're not carrying or using something, you know, something kind of obscure.
Yeah. What I like about that is that, A lot of us have aftermarket triggers and things on our guns. And so if you're running a cert gun, you're not going to have that same aftermarket trigger that you're used to on your duty weapon or your concealed carry pistol. So you're not going to get that same trigger press kind of thing. So that's kind of useful for that.
Yeah. Next product. And we could spend more time on some of these, but, this is more at this point, more of an overview because, I'm looking at the time and it's like, oh, we're going to be, you know, this would be a long episode if we just keep going the way we've been going. Dry Fire Mag would be another product. What is a Dry Fire Mag? So it goes, it pretty much is what it sounds like. It's a magazine you put into your gun. They've cleverly designed, you know, because it's specific to each gun, but there'll be like a little arm piece that interfaces typically with the trigger bar on your particular gun. Yeah, and what it does is, that the dry fire mag gives you a resetting trigger, and it gives you kind of a click. It's a little bit different than the click you would normally expect from when you actually fire your gun, or actually press a real trigger. But it is an option, and some people seem to really like it. It's probably the product I've used the least. And here's the thing. And so, hey, again, some people really like it, and you should definitely check it out if it's something you think would be good for you. I think it's probably pretty popular amongst the Glock users because one of the unique characteristics of a Glock is the trigger really only returns back forward when the slide cycles, whereas on some other guns like, say, a P320 or I'm carrying now a VP9 from HK, those triggers have a return spring that even though the striker has been released, the return spring on the trigger, you know, pushes the trigger back forward. And so you can still get some trigger manipulation without a click, but I will simulate, you know, repeat shots in dry fire, just because the trigger, you know, moves back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. But I want to say this too, by the way, and this is true even if you are a Glock user, you don't always have to press the trigger in dry fire to do effective dry fire. You don't always have to get a click in dry fire to be doing effective dry fire. Okay. And one of the things you'll see high level dry fire shooter types do is they will fire that first shot. And then after that first shot, they'll just keep working their finger as though the trigger was working. Okay. And they'll work their way through multiple shots. I do this all the time now. And the idea is that I'm putting a lot of my focus and attention into what I'm seeing, because that's honestly what a lot of shooting is about. And I'm monitoring my sights for movement as I'm manipulating the trigger back and forth. Or in the case of a Glock, I'm just slamming my finger into the back of the trigger guard, basically, over and over and over and over again. And I'm trying to do that without disruption in the sights of the gun. You'll see high-level shooters that do drive practice do this kind of thing all the time, where they continue manipulating the trigger, even if the trigger is not actually functioning still. So in that way, you don't necessarily have to be racking the slide between every single shot and between each iteration that you're doing in practice. It's just some food for thought, okay? But the dry fire mag is one of those products that, if it's available for your gun, it's not available for all models, but it's available for a lot more than it used to be, that's for sure. If you want to have a resetting trigger, an articulating trigger it's kind of a, what I would call a simulated click. It is a click. It's just not going to be the same kind of click as what you get when you normally press your trigger. You can check out Dry Fire Mag. Link in the show notes. We talked about dummy rounds. We talked about laser dot trainer. Let's talk about a couple of products, but these are more like on the software side. So there's the laser app. There's Laser Academy, which is a competitor and is from Mantis. And there's this virtual reality system, which I've been getting some experience on, called Ace XR. Have you messed around with any of those products at all?
I've seen you do it, and you made it look really fun.
It is fun. You know, if you have followed the Shoot Array Challenge series that I've filmed for like 3 years, you saw the laser app system get used a lot. I think it's not something that I would do every single dry fire session, although I know some people that do that. But it's something I used for the express purpose of mostly getting the time data out of, you know, what I was doing in dry fire. Mm. Okay. Because traditionally, as I mentioned earlier, the way to sort of integrate time pressure into dry fire was to use part times with your timer. And then it's just, you know, the honor system as far as, did I get that within the par or not? Okay. And that's still not the same thing as being able to just run a drill and see what the actual time, you know, readout is of doing said thing.
Right.
And that's what software systems like the Laser app, laserapp.com, or Mantis's Laser Academy. That's what, you know, they allow you to start now getting some of that, that time data. Right. So I like that occasionally in my dry fire so that I can see if what I'm doing is actually working without necessarily having to go to the range with an actual live shot timer with live rounds being fired. Hmm. You can still gather a lot of the same data. You have to be real about it, because obviously I can work a cert pistol's trigger really fast and get a lot of hits on target that's probably at a speed that's faster than what I would do if I was getting recoil. But you can also integrate Coolfire Trainer into using something like the Laser app with their laser module on there. And in that way, you do get some simulated recoil as well as hits recorded on target. And the software can read those laser hits and record that data. So that's kind of cool.
I was going to ask what you thought, how important recoil control is in this, because it's hard to replicate that with dry fire practice. And that's a big deal when it comes to follow-on shots and accuracy and that kind of thing. And you don't generally have that. I mean, your cert pistols and a lot of the stuff, especially that app, that video game, the virtual reality that you were getting into. Obviously, we're not going to have that recoil management. What are your thoughts on that?
Okay, so my thoughts are the closest thing you can get in dry fire is to use the Coolfire Trainer for recoil management type training. It's not exactly a perfect one-to-one, you know, comparison, but it is something, and that is something. The second thing I'll say is that as long as you're being honest, like as long as your technique is good, so like grip, especially grip technique is good, and you're being honest that in dry practice, you are actually gripping the same way you would grip in live fire, meaning gripping, including with the same amount of strength. Because it's really easy. And I'm glad you asked this, because it's a common pitfall that some shooters experience, that in dry fire, they tend to get a little bit lazy. Because, well, I don't have recoil. And I'm not saying people do it intentionally, but it happens very just sort of naturally.
Right.
You know, that because you subconsciously know there's not going to be a gun kicking you, so you're naturally not going to grip it as tight as what you normally would. So a curious thing happens in the virtual reality system, the Ace XR, that I haven't experienced anywhere else, and I don't know fully quite how to express it or make sense of it necessarily. But in that virtual reality system, even though the gun itself that has the controller and everything in it is not recoiling, is not moving, but virtually you observe and see the gun in the game, if you will, recoil. And that does something to me mentally I can't quite explain. But what I've noticed in that Ace XR system is that I grip really freaking hard. And I know that because I can only last about 3 minutes.
Oh.
And I'm like, oh,
man. You're not used to shooting for that length of time, huh?
Yeah, but, you know, and once I noticed it, I started paying attention to it. I'm like, whoa, I'm really gripping this tight. And I think part of that is because in the virtual reality world, you're looking at your sights and you're seeing every little thing, you know, every little bit of movement. And you know to minimize that movement, including this simulated, replicated, whatever virtual recoil, like it just causes me for whatever reason to bear down on the gun with a lot of grip pressure because I'm trying to minimize that movement as much as possible. So I'm not going to say it's a perfect analog for recoil management training. However, it's kind of trippy, and I think that it has resulted in some benefit for recoil control practice, even in dry fire.
Well, that's kind of what I'm getting across the board here, is that there's no one perfect system for dry fire practice. You kind of need a combination of a few of these, if not all of them. You know, I mean, imagine this will be something as your training journey progresses, you'll take things in and get rid of things that work for you and don't work for you and that kind of thing. But it seems like you're going to need something to kind of hit a various of all of these bases.
Yeah. Let's, so I apologize. I feel like we could probably do more justice even still on some of the products, but we've mentioned some. You're welcome to research them. The links for everything we mentioned is in the show notes, by the way. So I do encourage you guys to check those out. There is one thing we didn't mention. We mentioned the company, but we didn't actually mention the specific product. We mentioned the Laser Academy, but also made by Mantis, of course, is the pretty well-known Mantis X system. Or Mantis X10, which is probably the more popular one that people buy now. And that, of course, is just a device that records the movement in your gun as you're, especially as you're pressing the trigger and things like that. And that, you know, that I think that that has some value as well. I don't think it has to be the end-all, be-all solution for all the things, because it frankly can't be. But it is something that's interesting to mess around with and to train with. And I think there's some learning that can occur, absolutely, from using something like the Mantis X system as well.
My dad has the Mantis. He adores it. He loves it. That's his thing to do at night before he goes to bed. He breaks out the Mantis. He works on his reloads and all of his trigger controls and stuff, and he loves it.
Yeah. My one caution with that is don't let your dry fire become just this own, you know, this one thing, which I've seen a few people with the Mantis X system where the only thing they do is focused on being able to press the trigger at a somewhat moderate or slow pace and trying to get they're trying to get that score as high as possible, right? And I know there's like the different drills or benchmarks or things within the software, you know, that encourage you to do different types of trigger presses, but that's not all there is to dry fire. There's so many other things we need to practice. So just keep that in mind. But let's shift gears. Brian, I'm going to ask you, and this was something you put in here, talking about, you know, the context here is creating your dojo, getting the most out of your training in your home or at home or at the office, you know, for some people that are able to do that, like we are. And I know a few people at work, you know, in gun-friendly environments and actually, you know, do some dry fire and stuff in their office. But the point here is, let's talk about physical fitness. And I want to hear your thoughts on that. You know, you felt it was important to include in this discussion. So let's talk about that.
Well, I think one of the things, what are we doing here? I mean, this is martial arts. We're training for combat, you know, for warfare. And, you know, we can practice pulling our gun all day, every day, but if we can't get to the fight, or by the time we get to the fight, we're so tired, we can't fight. We're no good to anybody. We're just a casualty at that point. So, you know, I want to encourage everybody who's out there, who's listening to this, you know, good on you for learning these skills, but don't forget to take care of your body, because that's ultimately what's going to save you. You know, you have to have the ability to take care of yourself physically. And on top of that, if you get injured, you're more likely to recover from those wounds.
Yeah.
So having a frequent, you know, a workout program where you are mobile, functional movement, you don't have to be going to the gym and trying to look like Arnold Schwarzenegger. Even if you're just doing, you know, just a couple of push-ups, whatever you can do at that time,
yep,
just to kind of give yourself a little bit of a challenge. I know something that happens to me pretty often is I'll start a workout program and I'll just go way too hard on it, you know, and I'll last maybe a week or two. And then after a while, it just sucks so bad that, you know, I'll just stop, you know, and I found, yeah, a lot more success in something that is much more manageable. It's still challenging, but it's not so difficult. I'm just killing myself, yeah, all the time. And just having a baseline for functionality is something that is going to benefit you in all categories of your life and not just fighting.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you're thinking about, you know, like you want to get into this and you really enjoy guns and training and that kind of thing, we need to think about what we're doing and why and how we can do it more efficiently. Even if you're just doing something for competition, your life is not on the line or you're not worried about your survival. Even for competition, your economy of movement and your efficiency is going to skyrocket. Yeah. And then if you take a trip and a tumble, you know, you're not going to eat a face full of concrete. You'll be able to catch yourself and prevent yourself from serious injuries. So, in my opinion, I think physical fitness is one of the most important things that we can do. Probably the most important thing you can do for any sort of combat operations that we're preparing ourselves for. And so, like, anytime that I think about, you know, gun training, I'm thinking about martial arts. You know, it's a very similar things that go into training. You know, punching and kicking goes into drawing your own weapon and being able to fight, yeah, effectively. So, and I know you've been, also, your exercise journey lately has been improving pretty substantially. You've been back in the gym quite a bit too, right?
Yes. Yeah, that's true. You know, and it's been a process. And I think it's important to recognize that we're all at different points and places along the way. You know, whether it's with respect to gun-related skill, concealed carry stuff, whatever, or fitness and health. Some of you out there listening or watching might, you know, I mean, just due to age or due to injury, maybe difficult to do certain things. Some of us are overweight. Some of us aren't overweight. Some of us are trying to put on weight. Like, I have a friend that's trying to, you know, to bulk up and is, you know, is trying to do that because he has his reasons for, you know, he has his goals he wants to achieve. Me, I'm trying to go the opposite way. I'm trying to lose some weight. Happy to report I've lost about 10 pounds in the last, in fact, actually, when I hopped on the scale last night, I was almost exactly 10 pounds down from 3.5 weeks ago, I think. So I'm pretty happy about that. These pants I'm actually wearing, if I took my belt off and like just held out the waistband, there's about that much.
Time to buy a whole new wardrobe.
I have some pants on order. Yeah.
Well, I think one of the things that people often think about is that they're like, I need to do a lot, you know,
yeah,
and you don't, you know, a lot of times people will say, well, like, I'm not going to get any better. I'm like 85 years old. Like, what am I trying to do? You could always, yep, be a little bit better than you were before.
Yeah.
And if you're just a little bit healthier, that could make the difference between life and death for you.
And that's kind of where I was going with what I was saying too, is that it's not like, my point was, we're all kind of different places along the journey. Some of us, you know, including talking about fitness, are, you know, ahead of others or behind others or whatever it is. And that's okay. The point is to always try to be moving in the right direction. Like, doing something today that makes you a little bit better and a little bit stronger, a little bit healthier, a little bit faster, whatever it is, right? It's the same approach to what we were talking about with dry fire. That, I, you know, what did I say? Just do 10 minutes a day consistently, and you're going to improve a lot as a shooter, right? Same approach on the fitness side. You know, like, you can always go more hardcore if you want, but you can just take 10 minutes a day and get up out of your chair and go for a walk. You know, if that's all you can do today, we'll do that, because that's better than not going on a walk, mm-hmm, right? It's moving the needle in the right direction. Something else you can do today, pay attention to what you eat. So I've been tracking my food for the last 3+ weeks, and it's interesting just by tracking it, the difference that's made in my food choices.
Oh, you're more aware of what you're eating.
Yeah. And I know like people have told me that before, but I was always like, oh, it sounds like brain damage to actually, you know, track. And it kind of is, but the cool thing is in today's world, you know, there's things like apps that make it, and some of those have existed for a long time, but like app technology just gets better and better all the time, and it makes it easier. Like I'm using MyFitnessPal, and I know that it's been around for a few years, but and I'm paying the subscription for it because, and you know why? I was like, you know what? If you got the subscription, you can use the barcode reader, and I eat something, and I just scan the barcode, and I go, that's how much I ate, and it takes like that long. And that I'm like, if I'm going to actually track, I have to make it as simple and as brain dead as possible. Meaning like requires very little brain power to execute. So I was like, okay, Mike, let's pay the whatever $7 a month. I can't remember what it is, you know, like it's probably going to be worth it in the end. And so that's what I've been doing. And it's actually made a huge difference. And I'm certainly, paying for the app because I'm not eating as much. So that alone is covering the cost of that premium membership but there's other apps too and stuff out there. But anyway, fitness is important. Everything you said is 100% true. I've been kind of on a journey for a few years. I've also had some setbacks with some knee problems, some ankle problems. But I'll tell you, man, I ran 4 miles up a mountain the other day and back down again. And my calves are a little bit sore today. My knees feel amazing. Mm. I mean, they don't feel like amazing, but they don't feel like I ran 4 miles up and down a mountain.
Well, what I want to know is how your brain feel. You feel good about that?
I feel great about that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. It was good.
Yeah.
I'm going to do more of that.
That is, I honestly believe, you know, like you can say all this stuff about being better, you know, and being in better shape so you look better or you fight better or whatever the case is. But ultimately, working out is just so good for your brain.
Yeah.
You know, like when you come down from accomplishing something like that and you get to tell somebody, there's a little dopamine hit there. Like I can see that smile on your face. Like you're reliving that moment where you just pushed yourself and did something that a lot of other people probably can't do, you know, or wouldn't want to do. You know, because it's just too difficult, you know, but now you have, you know, you get to carry yourself a little bit better and feel a little bit better. I know for myself, I have to do things like that on at least every 3 months or my brain starts to eat itself, you know, but I'll go out every 3 months and do a long, hard ruck march or a long run or just do something crazy. And, and that will provide me with a lot of motivation to keep going. A lot of energy comes from that for me.
Awesome. Yeah, man. All right. So don't overlook physical fitness. And it does help in all these other areas. Your dry fire, for instance, your grip will improve if you get stronger. Mm. think about that.
You'll move faster from target to target.
Yeah, you know? So all good things. Last things here to kind of start wrapping up this episode. We want to talk about some online training resources. Okay, so one of the episode sponsors today, of course, is Guardian Nation, which, of course, that's our membership program. Something, you know, I already gave you the pitch earlier, but something worth looking into. We've got hours upon hours upon hours of training content for members in Guardian University. Guardian University, by the way, is open to anybody. You can actually buy any of the courses a la carte and have access to it anytime you want virtually in Guardian University. But Guardian Nation members get full, complete, unfettered access to Guardian University and the dozens and dozens, actually like hundreds of hours of training content in Guardian University. So that right there alone is, I think, worth it to be a Guardian Nation member.
And on top of that, discounts for all the products for dry fire.
Yeah, all the products we mentioned, right? So anyway, that's an online training resource. I also want to mention the Dry Fire Corner, which this is a new feature we added to our site just a month or two ago. So if you go to concealedcarry.com, up in the upper right-hand corner, it says Dry Fire Corner. And by the way, we've put a whole bunch of dry fire training resources on that page. So you click on that corner, click on the upper right-hand corner just where it says Dry Fire Corner. It's going to load the Dry Fire Corner page. And then there's just resource after video after product, like all this stuff all right there for your convenience, so you can access Dry Fire Corner when and it's free to access, of course. And so check out Dry Fire Corner at concealedcarry.com, another great online training resource. Tell us about the next thing here. It's listed, Mountain Man Medical's free course.
Never heard of them. Oh, no, I don't know anything about them. Oh, now, well, hey, dry fire practice for medical training.
Yeah.
That's important. Do you know how to put on a tourniquet? Do you know how to put on the tourniquet the right way? Have you practiced putting on a tourniquet? Probably not, right? Well, you need to try it out. You need to practice a little bit. Mountain Man Medical, we got a free course, teach you how to do all that stuff. Mountain Man Medical, you can check out. We've got training tourniquets, so you can do your own dry fire practice. Like, don't forget, shooting guns is important. Knowing how to patch yourself after all the shooting's done is also important. So make sure you're learning these good skills. Now, I always like to say that medical training is not nearly as physically intensive as shooting. Like, there's so many things that you have to go into that you've got to remember for all the little different things that you got to do. But medical, a lot of it's more of just your knowledge. You're not really working on your skills nearly as much. Putting on a tourniquet is not that difficult to learn, so you don't have to recover that stuff so often. So I generally recommend maybe quarterly or twice a year that you need to go back and review all of this stuff, maybe have some partners that you can practice with and that kind of thing to keep it on the top of your head. So this is not something that you got to be working on every single day, but maybe quarterly, maybe twice a year, break out all your stuff and redo the course and practice all of the skills that are involved, because you don't want to be trying to make that up on the fly when the time counts. So that might be a good option for you.
Awesome. Yeah, guys, go to mountainmanmedical.com and you can just click, there's a button or a tab that says training, and that'll take you to it. But also you can click the link that's in the show notes of today's episode too. Last thing that I have here listed is called Dry Fire King. And Dry Fire King, I think we're actually a sponsor of. It's a YouTube channel. And so what Dry Fire King is it's kind of competition focused as far as like the targets and things and how it presents them. But I think just about anybody could benefit from using Dry Fire King. And so what Dry Fire King is a bunch of basically dry fire videos with different target setups. And it also includes on a number of the videos, moving targets. And that's actually one of the harder things to be able to access and train, especially in dry practice, because a lot of times you're more in a static environment. And so it's good to mix it up a little bit and, you know, have the practice of, oh, I've got to track that target and still be aware of my sights and be able to get good hits on it, for instance. And yes, a lot of those are going to be movers where it's kind of, you know, like a swinger that just goes back and forth like this. And that might not necessarily replicate perfect, true, like human, you know, movement, let's say. However, the practice or the principle of a moving target and being able to follow that and see a sight picture and get good hits on, that's the same. Okay. That doesn't really change. Check out Dry Fire King. It's also just a way to mix up dry practice. Like, there's lots of times I do stuff more in a static environment, but then there's times it's like, no, let's launch. Like, I'll pull up, you know, most of us have the ability to pull up, say, like YouTube or something on our TVs. Most TVs nowadays are smart TVs, of course. And so if you got that, pull up Dry Fire King on YouTube and I'll just launch one of their videos and that'll be my dry fire session for the day. You know, a lot of the videos are, you know, 5, 6, 8, 10 minutes long. And so, or I might do, you know, a couple of those videos and I'll just launch that and that's my dry practice. And it gives you like par times and things. So it's like, hey, you know, on this next thing, you're going to shoot all the targets or whatever, you know, or you're going to do all the targets and reload and then shoot them again, or it gives you kind of a scenario, if you will. And you just go through that and I'll just make that my dry practice for the day. I'll probably do that, honestly, like about once a week. Could do it more, but honestly, with what I do already in dry practice, I'm pretty happy with. And just having that opportunity to mix it up once a week, I think is pretty cool and kind of fun and just kind of keeps things fresh.
Yeah, you keep it interesting, you're more likely to do it, right?
Yeah.
I think that's one of the hard parts about this is that you got to do it on your own. So you got to be self-disciplined. One of the good things about going to the range is it's more social. You know, you got your friends there, you got people there, you know, so it's a little easier to go there and get that done. So, yeah.
Yeah. I'll just mention one more thing. And I don't often like self-promote things for myself, even on the podcast, but I'll go ahead and throw this out there. There's also opportunities, to your point, a lot of this stuff has to be done alone. However, it doesn't have to all be done alone. And there are ways to get some coaching virtually, which is definitely encouraged. There are a number of instructors, including friends of mine, that do virtual coaching. I'll just mention some names. Tim Herron would be one. Chris Bean at Tactical Advantage. Tyler Tharp of Synergy Training Group. And myself also. And there's probably, I know there's others, but like those are some friends of mine and guys I trust that do virtual coaching. And to give you an idea what that might look like sometimes is you set up like a Zoom or a FaceTime call or that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And you set up your phone and to where the instructor can watch what you're doing. And then you work through some dry fire drills and then they can just provide you some instantaneous feedback virtually.
In your own house.
In your own home.
That's amazing. So if you've got somebody who's like really uncomfortable around guns and wants to get comfortable with them before actually going to the range, that could be an option for them.
Yep. Hmm. So you can check out Tim Herron, Chris Bean, Tyler Tharp, and others. If you'd like to do any virtual coaching or anything like that with me, you can go to rileybowman.com and I have a link right there that says coaching. And that's where you'll find details on setting up a virtual training or coaching session with me. Happy to do that with you. I also think it's very affordable. I mean, it's not free, but I think it's pretty affordable. And I think it's good value. I've done some virtual coaching for myself with other instructors. So really, really good value there to be had. Hmm. So I think that, we covered a lot. It's been about 90 minutes or so.
What? Really? Holy crap.
So thank you everybody for tuning in. I hope that this second installment of the Uncensored Beginner's Guide to Training, Create Your Dojo, was helpful for you. Give you some ideas on both training, approaches and setups and, you know, how to do things safely, products, online resources, all of that. I hope you got something out of this episode here today. Brian, final thoughts or words or anything you want to leave with the listeners?
Well, be ready for whatever the mountain throws at you, and Doc loves you.
Awesome, awesome. Likewise, guys, appreciate your support. And again, our sponsors today, besides our title sponsor, which is HK, we've got dryfireproshop.com, which pretty much, I don't think quite everything we talked about today is on Dry Fire Pro Shop. Like, I don't think, for instance, you can buy Mantis Laser Academy. But pretty much all the other products that we talked about today, I think you can find in dryfireproshop.com. And again, you'll also find the links in the show notes. Also, guardiannation.com. And so with that, until next time, a reminder to train right, train often, and train safe so you can fight hard, fight fast, and fight true. Take care. A reminder that laws vary from place to place, and we encourage listeners to seek local legal advice to understand applicable laws. Concealed Carry Inc., its brands and properties, and the Concealed Carry Podcast is not a legal service, nor are we attorneys at law. We make our best faith effort to share concealed carry-related insights and information about firearm-related incidents and the laws pertaining based on our own understanding and experience. But things can be different where you live, or laws may have changed by the time you listen to this. We cannot be held liable for your actions based on the information shared in this podcast. Please exercise care with all things pertaining to firearm use, concealed carry, and always practice following basic firearm safety rules. More information about safety can be found at concealedcarry.com/safety.